Thank you to Lenore and Ron Hayes for inviting us today to present on the UCLA Health System Patient Safety Institute. And I know most of the people here are very knowledgeable regarding the patient safety problem in the United States, but just to orient you with one very recent study, and this came out in March 2011. It was a report published by HealthGrades, Patient Safety in American Hospitals. And this particular group analyzed Medicare data from 07 to 09, 40 million hospitalization records for approximately 5,000 non-federal hospitals. And what they found in their analysis was more than 608,600,000 total patient safety events affecting more than 667 Medicare beneficiaries. And these safety events resulted in almost 80,000 patient deaths. And 1 in 10 surgical patients died after developing the following treatable complications that are listed there. And then 13 outlier patient safety events were associated with an excess of $7.3 billion in cost. So this is just a recent example of how enormous the patient safety problem is across the United States.
Is that 13 kinds? It's not 13 individual events.
13 it was 13 patient safety events were associated with 7.3 billion.
So those are categories.
And what are examples of events? I guess.
I mean, you don't mean like an individual patient.
I meant categories.
Pulmonary yes. emboli.
Right.
And by and I can send this report to people if you're interested in the details.
Do you think that the definition was conservative of what they could detect for this analysis? Are there like many more under this iceberg, or is it?
Quite possibly. This is all taken from administrative data, so there's always limitations to what you're going to find in that. This is not medical abstract, and we're not abstracting records here, so this is probably the best case scenario.
Understood.
Well, or let's say you're really sick and you die, and you get things that happen to you.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, some of them might be people who would have died anyway.
So it could have been an overestimate for some and an underestimate for others. So
I know one of our former fellows here, Rod Hayward, has written about that and says that it's seriously overinflated.
Mm-hmm.
But the Boston Mafia, of course, believe that it's all true.
Nevertheless, I think we can all agree that improvements could be made in patient safety. Now, this is a contextual slide that tells us something about some of the other patient safety research centers across the United States that are affiliated with academic health centers at Hopkins, Duke, Harvard, Stanford, University of California, San Francisco, for example. And so now we have one at UCLA, and we're in very good company, obviously. So today's presentation will be really in two parts. First, an overview of our Patient Safety Institute and some of our progress over the past year or so, and a suggestion about what the next frontier might be. And then I'm going to turn it over to my colleague Jim Morrison, who's a senior researcher who's going to talk specifically about internal and external data that we use for analysis, and then also a recent award that he received from the University of California Office of the President to examine Medicare reimbursement related to safety concerns. So first, our leadership, David Feinberg from the UCLA Hospital System and Courtney Leiter, the Dean of the School of Nursing, are co-chairs of our advisory board think tank. And I'm sure most people are familiar with David and Courtney. And we have an advisory board that includes the health system executives and interdisciplinary Patient Safety Institute investigators and researchers who serve as thought leaders. And this is essentially a list of our advisory boards. So you can see people in the room probably know many of these people who are executives at the UCLA Health System, the CMO, Tom Rosenthal, the Chief Nursing Officer, Heidi Crooks, Molly Coy, Posey Carpenter, Chief Administrative Officer from Santa Monica, and so on and so forth, in addition to interdisciplinary faculty investigators, some of which happen to be our Patient Safety Institute Associate Directors, including Jerry Kaminsky, Jack Needleman, and Dina Fifi. Yes, Ron.
How would we detect? I do recognize a lot of those people. Yeah. Some are in public health, but I don't see anyone from this.
From GIM?
Yeah.
Well, we're open to expanding it. These were just the initial people that were recruited to the advisory board. And so they're pretty, I guess it's pretty much on the health system side. So maybe that was a limitation and we need to think more about leadership from GIM, for example, and other places. Yes.
So were you shooting to make sure that you got no one who ever touched a patient?
Well, I would say Kathy Ward doesn't touch patients.
No.
What about...
Two of the people up there do.
Gina Buffy, no?
No.
Let's see.
Tom Rosenberg.
Mary Ann Shinnick.
No. Yeah. Oh, Tom, yeah, like one Wednesday a month.
So Edith Matasik, for example?
Yeah.
No?
No, Tom Strauss does.
Well, what? You know, you're what? The first person that raised that issue. How about Anna Galinsky?
Stedman does.
How about Galinsky? Okay, Stedman.
Yeah, yeah.
We got Stedman.
Feinberg touches them up for money.
Yeah, I mean, so,
you know, we're recording
so what exactly are they advising on?
On the creation of the Institute and providing leadership in terms of the kinds of initiatives that we should pursue and pilot grant awards and really how to begin to integrate the campus resources with the health system and the hospital resources to begin that integration, because culturally, as you know, it's very different from the health system side and the academic side. So, but you pointed out a great...
So for that, this would be a good point.
Yeah, well, right. You pointed out a great limitation. We appreciate that. So we can certainly, in the future, think about who else should be on this advisory board. Yes.
I was just wondering if... Guys, and you don't have to answer now, but we'd be open to fellows or trainees sitting on this board at some point. A lot of the committees at UCLA are, you know, allow for trainees to participate too. I don't know.
That's excellent.
To consider.
Okay. Well, thank you.
And are there any patients, Susan? Right?
Well, you know, we had two Freeman community now. People. Seth Freeman, is he on there?
Yeah.
And he is it true that his family actually experienced a patient safety concern firsthand, and that was his interest in actually being on the board and really representing the patient in the community perspective.
I think so, although I think this family gets care at Cedars.
So, but you thank you for pointing out areas where we can certainly strengthen our advisory board. So essentially our vision is to imagine the safest, not unlike GE, we'd like to imagine the safest healthcare system in the world. The UCLA hospital system, and our mission is very aligned with the Institute of Medicine in terms of transforming healthcare through safe, effective, efficient, patient-centered, and we added innovative care because we're UCLA. And we want to realize the vision and mission through R&D, intervention, innovation, policy analysis, research training, and workforce development. So that's essentially where we're starting out. And in terms of our own organizational competencies, and these can probably be updated, but we were trying to identify what are our competencies that are unique that we really bring. And essentially, we partner with the health system leaders and the clinical leaders to conduct collaborative initiatives to improve safety. We create and support innovative pilot grant awards. We process, analyze, and report internal and external data to identify gaps and continuously improve performance. And we train the future leaders in safety research. And you have to understand that we've only been in operation essentially 12 months. So we haven't had a long timeline yet. But this coming out of the gate, these were the areas that we really wanted to be able to distinguish ourselves in. You can't really see this slide. I'm just now noticing, but this is our operations model. I'm not going to spend a lot of time with it. This is essentially our business model, if you will. And essentially, the left side shows our interface with the health system and how we vet projects through the health system and the advisory board. And then here is our service line, which essentially is very familiar to anyone who does research. Development, support to bring in money, project management, literature review, internal analyses using longitudinal data, comparative reporting using external data, and cost analysis. And essentially we have Jerry Kaminsky and I know your name.
Jim
Morrison, actually, that are focusing on the cost analysis piece. And then we do, you know, certain research activities to try to ultimately demonstrate measurable improvement in patient safety. So essentially, this is, I'll just say a little bit more about our progress, a timeline of accomplishments. I'll give you an example of one of the collaboratives that we're currently working on. I'll say something about our good fortune in being able to co-fund with the Clinical and Translational Science Institute. So we were able to co-fund some pilot grants this year, and then maybe briefly mention the postdoctoral fellowship program before turning it over to Jim. But this is essentially our timeline, and we really did start about a year ago. We had some time for planning and opening up the office, but we essentially hired our staff and our associate directors in January of 2011. So really, in all fairness, we've had about 1 year of operating experience. Essentially, this is an example of one of our collaboratives. It's really interesting. It's on hardwiring and sustaining patient safety in the Department of Nursing. And actually, it's a program that was developed by Dr. Maria O'Rourke called the Role-Based Practice Solutions. And essentially, the program itself is designed to improve the RN's role knowledge related to being a practitioner, a leader, a scientist, and a transfer of knowledge. And Maria O'Rourke has worked on this for probably 2+3 decades. She's been working in this area. And essentially, the program itself, it strengthens the knowledge of the practitioner, of the RNs in those areas. So they're really assessing the knowledge of their role, what their role should be, and then also observing their actual practice using handoffs to identify the gaps in performance and then provide coaching to improve performance. So it's a fascinating program. Our role from the Patient Safety Institute perspective is essentially to design and conduct the evaluation. And so this is really the first time that the O'Rourke program has been evaluated to this extent in a more rigorous way, and we're actually seeking funding to do that now. But to investigate the effects of the program on changing knowledge behavior, and then also to examine associations with organizational outcomes, we'll use a quasi-experimental design to compare the intervention units and the control units. Of course, we'll conduct multivariate analysis to look at significant predictors of knowledge and behavior change, and then we'll widely disseminate the report because there's great interest these days in the development of RNs and their role that they can play in healthcare reform. So that's one example of a collaborative. These are other initiatives that we're working on currently at PSI. The first one is role-based practice solutions I just spoke to you about. The one called Systems-Based Learning Program for Translating Patient Safety Competencies is interprofessional with the School of Nursing and the School of Medicine. Courtney is the PI, and Luann Wilkerson will be the co-PI. And then we have a team together, including Margie Stuber, you may know her, and Sarah Kim, for example. So that's one that's in process. Effects of State Policy and Safety Net Characteristics on Patient Safety. That's one that I'm leading on, and Jack Needleman is prominent in that one, given his work in the safety net area. And then Jack is leading on, it's mainly a concept paper right now. It's called Capacity to Rescue. And it's really, he would like to develop a center around the Capacity to Rescue area.
What does that mean?
Okay, well, it has to do with, it's really has four components to it. it has to do, it's someone have to refresh my memory that's been working.
It's formally it's a different name for the ARC, failure to measure risk, failure to rescue measure, which is those kind of surgical complications whereby had we got to them on time, where kind of rapid response teams might be involved, but we could have prevented death, basically. So it's surgical patients who die where it could have been prevented.
And it may be done in collaboration with Dartmouth. And do you know the four areas, Laura, because you were helping with Lit Review?
It's been a while. Human factors, technology.
Systems. So he had four different areas that he's conceptualizing, and he'd like to develop his center. I wish Jack was here today. He's on the East Coast. He wished that he could be here to explain it himself. But that's it. It's essentially a concept paper. Okay, and then one by Marianne Shinnick from Nursing on simulation training for ICU nurses. And then this is one that Michael Ong is familiar with, Aurelia O'Connell. She's been working with Michael, and this one is on effectiveness of wireless technology and low literacy patients. And then Jim just was notified of this award on Friday, and we're just really very pleased. He'll talk more about his award next.
Can you say something about the first one you mentioned, organizational outcomes, what those are?
You know, this is one we really pushed. That was one that we really pushed the team on, and essentially we believe that we'll use nurse-sensitive measures, but it was one of those evaluation moments where you had to really help the program team focus much more on what it would be possible to have a direct impact on. And so it's an area that Maria O'Rourke has never really ventured into, because we all know that showing impact in terms of organizational outcomes is more difficult. But we, the evaluation team at PSI, is really pushing that team on making sure that their intervention could have a direct impact on org outcomes, and then we seek to measure it. So it's an area that will be more challenging, but we are pushing them. We're pushing the envelope on that one, and we're trying to see, because if we're able to demonstrate that, I think it would really strengthen the credibility of a program. So in terms of Patient Safety Institute, Clinical and Translational Science Institute, pilot grant co-funding, we've been able to co-fund five pilots this year. And they're listed here, Barbara Bates Jensen, which I'm going to show a really quick video clip on that one. Randy Stedman and his work in simulation. Aurelia, I already spoke about. This is a pilot grant that she's working on. She's already turning it into an NIH proposal. Linda Phillips is very interested in transitions of older, frail, elderly, and the safety concerns. When they transition from different levels of care. And then Arnand is actually, this is a very interesting study on identification of patients to make sure that they get the correct radiotherapy. So, but let me say more, let's dig a little bit or drill a little bit deeper on one of these, which is fascinating. This is the one that is being conducted by Barbara Bates Jensen and a team, including William Kaiser and Majid at, Bruin Biomed. And these are the aims around detecting and preventing pressure ulcers in critically ill patients. So we have a clip on this. Let me see if I could just clip into it here. Is that too loud?
Thank you.
vanguard in wireless medical technology and mobile health applications. Bruin Biometrics is a wireless health technology company developing a robust portfolio of applications designed to provide clinicians and patients with actionable data to detect and monitor various medical conditions for evidence-based treatment in any setting. Born out of technology at UCLA's Wireless Health Institute, Bruin Biometrics is bringing to market innovative, intelligent wireless medical devices.
Pressure ulcers are areas of skin and tissue damage that occur when the soft tissue is compressed between the bony prominence and the external surface for prolonged periods of time. They typically affect some of our most vulnerable populations, frail elders and persons with limited mobility. The Joint Commission estimates that 2.5 million patients will be affected with pressure ulcers in acute care hospitals each year. Pressure ulcers increase the mortality rate of hospitalized patients by over 7%.
Technology is a driving force for shaping health.
60,000 patients die from pressure ulcer-related complications each year,
and
they're expensive. The U.S. expenditures for pressure ulcers are estimated at $11 billion a year. The current standard for assessing pressure ulcer damage is doing a visual inspection of the patient's skin to look for skin color changes. But visual assessment is problematic. By the time you see damage on the skin, it's already occurred underneath the surface of the skin. Suspected deep tissue injury are lesions where there's been significant damage underneath the intact skin at the bony tissue interface. They present as a purple maroon discoloration on the skin and rapidly progress to full thickness ulceration. Even experts have difficulty picking up erythema on all persons. Use of a biophysical measure might help with these problems, something that measured damage below the skin surface without taking into account the color of the skin. I've been studying surface electrocapacitance measured with a handheld device in nursing home patients and spinal cord injury patients. I've been looking at the use of this technology as a method to detect early pressure damage before it's visible on the surface of the skin.
Professor Barbara Bates Jensen had performed a series of pioneering studies to understand the relationship between subepidermal moisture, or SEM, and the presence of pressure ulcers that she showed is an indicator of the early stages of pressure ulcers.
As the level of visible skin damage increases, so does the measure of subepidermal moisture.
Okay, so that's just an example of the pilot study. I'm not going
to... a method to detect early skin damage before it's visible on the surface of the skin. In fact, in our nursing home studies, we were able to detect 25 to 30% of the stage 1 plus pressure ulcers that developed the next week.
Okay, so that's an example. Just wanted to share that. And, okay, now I'm back to square zero. So that's an example of a pilot. And these are the others. And I'm not going to go into the details of all the pilots. I just wanted to say in closing, before I turn it over to Jim, something about the next frontier with the Patient Safety Institute. We think that it might be, there may be an opportunity to actually strategically partner with the CTSI, with the community program, CCRR, and the regulatory programs to design and test a program to ensure safety in community-engaged research. So that's just a new frontier that came up yesterday, and also Arlene Brown is interested in having some discussions in this area. So it would allow us to move purely out of the acute care setting and to begin to do some innovative kinds of programs more in the ambulatory setting. So that essentially is, I guess the last comment would be on our postdoctoral fellowship program. And this is a program that we launched last year. And essentially this would provide anywhere from 1 to 2, probably 1 to 2 years for a postdoc to actually do advanced research training in patient safety to further launch one's career. So essentially here are some additional key publications.
and contact information, and these slides are available. I'd like now to turn it over to Jim Morrison to talk more about the data that I think this group might be interested in and your recent award.
Okay, thank you. This is 2003, right? So as Paula said, we were charged with our mission is to be the safest healthcare system in the world. So when we started, that's no small challenge. And I guess the first question was, well, how would you know if you're the safest healthcare system in the world? And how do you just begin with such a large system as the UCLA health system? What do you start to measure, or what measurements are out there? So we started pretty much from scratch, looking throughout the hospital system to see what internal measures were there, what was useful, you know, why do we measure anything? I mean, ideally, I think we measure to see if there's a problem and then to have a baseline from which we could kind of measure our improvements. So it's quite a challenge in itself. Whenever we first set up, we worked very closely with Jennifer Menzik, who has since left us, but she was the director of quality and safety, and this was the kind of the beginning of her life, was trying to put together this ultimate dashboard that there's so many different measures that you're required to take. There's measures that you're interested in. So when we kind of looked at it, we thought, okay, well, let's try and kind of break it down into different categories. What is this patient safety thing? It's a kind of a diffuse notion in many ways, and it's a relatively new discipline to actually just look at patient safety. So we kind of thought about, well, culture of safety, that idea about how does the institution work? How does it embrace safety? How do the staff work? Is there a thrust behind safety in the system? Is it institutionalized? Is it siloed? How does that work? So that's actually measured in by a Moorhead. It's actually a survey that's carried out by consultants. It's done. You, most of you have probably actually done this, and it's incorporated in a staff satisfaction survey. I'm going to talk a little bit more about that later. Then obviously there's the administrative data, the billing data, the ICD-9 codes, and this is the source that I suspect most of us use, or a lot of us use. Because it's very detailed, you can run a lot of numbers with it. It's what CMS uses. It's kind of the standard, but it's also for those of you who are at the retreat, actually the EHSR retreat, it was Hallie was talking about. There's real limitations to using billing data because it doesn't tell the complete story. But right now, this is probably the source that we look at most, and the UHC clinical database has a lot of tools that are very useful. Given those limitations, then obviously there's nursing reports. There's the Department of Nursing. They gather their own nursing sensitive indicators, falls, pressure ulcers, those types of things. And then there's other reports that go to the dashboard, the surgical care improvement. There's event reporting. Then we actually met with all of these people to get a sense of, you know, what do you have. And my background is actually in investments and finance and stuff, and I my mind boggled just at the paucity of information and the quality of it and the reliability of it, and how it was very patchwork. And so, you know, we're still working. We meet with people all the time to try and fill in this picture of what are our safety metrics and what do they really tell us. We obviously met with infection prevention. They have their own areas that they look at, and then risk management, the actual events, the errors and those types of things. So this was the kind of just trying to fill in the picture of, okay, what do we have? What's currently being measured? And then we want to look at, well, how do we know if any of that's any use to us, or are we doing good? Are we doing bad? I mean, we don't expect to be perfect. I mean, I think we can all agree that there are always going to be some safety concerns because we're human. So then we kind of went out to look and see, well, what can we compare them against? And obviously CMS is a big source of national data. But again, I was kind of, you know, you have very limited sets here. You can see the kind of the time ranges for different measures. You know, CDPH does, CDC. There are many different methodologies, many different ways of looking at things, and some of them are useful and some of them aren't, is what we find. There's generally a lack of uniformity. And as I said, coming from the financial world where every single thing. You know, you have accountants that are measuring every single thing. If you want to look at a, you know, a portfolio, or if you want to look at an investment, it's very easy to get very detailed data on everything about that. Obviously, for numerous reasons, the data partially just to do with the fact that it's a relatively young discipline, but also the nature of hospital work. It's hard and time consuming, and maybe not always that productive to spend a lot of time measuring these things. I think there's constant trade-offs in what you measure and whether or not it's useful.
Well, before you go on.
Yes.
That's HCAPS, the second one, right?
Yes.
Now, there's not a map, direct map to internal, because I know that's measured here as well, internally.
It is measured internally, and they are. I mean, a lot of these will be. We'll be on these measures. So the HCAPS is measured internally, and you will actually get scores from HCAP that will compare your patient satisfaction to national that's collected by CMS. So
okay, I was trying to figure out, you showed us internal first. That wasn't a comprehensive list of internal.
No, these are just a sample of the kind of things that we looked at. There isn't a comprehensive list. That's kind of there's so many different things you can measure, and as we were talking about earlier, there's things that kind of cross into what's quality and what's safety. HCAPS is kind of in the middle as well, in terms of like good communication between doctors and patients. Does lead to good safety, but it's kind of in between. So yeah, a lot of these, you know, we're on hospital compare, the hospital acquired conditions. California Department of Public Health, we actually did very poorly in that. The California Department of Public Health, if you recall, they kind of rushed that out. They didn't provide any methodology for that. So the first report that came out from January 2009 to March 2010 was ultimately meaningless for the hospital-acquired infections, because every hospital was doing it differently. They have since kind of rolled out and kind of requested that hospitals use the CDC guidelines, and so hopefully we'll start to get a better measure of hospital-acquired infections. But right now, we really don't. We actually don't really know. I mean, we have some idea of how our system is doing, and then some statistics from other places, but not really a very good way to measure things. The hospital acquired conditions, those numbers, the third one down, the October 8th to June 10th, those were, you probably heard about those, but those, we did very poorly in catheter-associated infections, vascular catheter-associated infections. This was released publicly, and that's kind of part of the issue. Is CMS, these were not risk-adjusted figures. They just released the figures and kind of do with this what you will. And there was actually a news article recently about how Ronald Reagan was the worst in Los Angeles based on those figures. But again, the methodology, it wasn't very fair reporting, and they've since come out with better risk-adjusted figures. But there's always challenges to what figures are reported, and you can always kind of question the methodology.
Please. Can I question your comparison of sort of what you get in the financial world to what is reported in healthcare? I mean, isn't it that if you wanted analogous stuff to this in the financial world, you'd get measures of whether a car company sold cars that got people to the place they wanted to on time is a much better comparison rather than number of units sold?
Well, yeah, number of units sold. I'm more just thinking about the fact that the comparison I was trying to make is there's a profession, and they're bean counters, they're accountants. Their job is to go. I'm thinking about how you might look at a company and their performance in all of these different aspects. But accountants will look at whether or not the car, you know, how successful the product is, but it's also how many of them we sold. You can get a much more comprehensive picture of a Fortune 500 company down to, you know, figures and details about every last. You know, how the production lines work, for example, and what the effectiveness and the efficiency of any given area within a company might be. I guess more generally is the fact that you kind of know what's measured, and you can kind of go and a lot of this data is publicly available within a standardized kind of format. In terms of if you're a publicly traded company, you know, you have reporting requirements that are, you know, national. They go across the board. Every company has to report the same type of data in the same format. There's, you know, generally accepted accounting principles. Maybe a slightly there may be questions in that analogy, but it was more, I suppose, from my perspective, is, you know, I'm coming to look at data. I want to find something that's meaningful, something that we can use, and that's where I was kind of shocked in the fact that I found that there wasn't. particularly in the time frames and the kind of the consistency and how the data is collected. That was more my. Does that make sense? Or we just, as I said, as a kind of how I saw it, I was a little shocked that the data wasn't better, I guess.
Right. Although I think the data you're looking for exists perfectly. You know exactly what the bottom lines are for every one of these companies. You know how many patients they see. You know exactly how many procedures are done. I think that's what's available, right? And what you're looking at here is a series of outcomes that's at a very different level, right? Like, are the kids really enjoying playing with their Slinkies or not?
Right. Okay. So, again, we were looking for a place to start. So we kind of, you know, obviously we had a lot of different initiatives, but if we're trying to get our head around, you know, what's going to make us the safest hospital system in the world, we thought, well, the culture of safety would be the obvious place to start. So in terms of looking for a good measure, as I said, we have the Moorhead questionnaire, which is done by, not to knock Moorhead, they're a perfectly reputable company, but we kind of looked and said, is this a good measure? Is this telling us what we want to know about the culture of safety within Ronald Reagan and Santa Monica hospitals? We looked at the instrument that was being used, and then we went to the kind of the national standard, which is the ARC hospital survey on patient safety culture, which is valid, reliable. You have kind of what you need there. I have a national database for comparison, and will allow me by unit-to-unit level to kind of assess, well, what is the culture of safety there? So as I said, we compared ARC to the Moorhead, and what we found is that this, what's currently been done in the health system is a much kinder, gentler kind of the questions, the items on the Moorhead questionnaire, and I'm not sure who actually designed this, are not quite as kind of direct. So for example, you know, a Moorhead questionnaire might be, I'm provided with sufficient timely information to do my job, you know, yes or no, or I agree or whatever. Whereas the ARC is much more piercing and said, staff are afraid to ask questions when something does not seem right. And there's lots of these, you know, my work unit is adequately staffed, agree or disagree, or we use more agency or temporary staff than is best for patient care. So we brought this to our advisory board, and we brought it to Dr. Feinberg and said, you know, we'd like to institute this throughout the hospital because we feel that we need a better measure of what the culture of safety is. And he was in agreement with that, except that he didn't want to add more questionnaires to the staff. They're already overburdened. There's a questionnaire burnout. And that's something that we might want to roll out in a couple of years. But this initiative kind of died there because there's only so much you can do. He was like, yes, let's do it, and hopefully we will do it, and you know, maybe in a year or two when the next questionnaire is rolled out. But right now, we kind of came to a kind of a dead end in this because we don't have the measure we want.
Wasn't there just going to replace that one?
Sorry?
Wasn't there just going to be a substitution?
We were hoping to do a substitution with basically Moorhead is 21 items, the ARC is 50 items.
Well, that's the problem.
And he didn't want to. We're hoping that we will do, but he didn't want to bring a brand new survey. So the next time the patient safety or the staff satisfaction survey is done, we're hoping to substitute them, but as I said, there's some reluctance.
So you wanted to use the ARC survey?
Yes.
And the hospital currently uses the Moorhead.
Correct.
And the Moorhead, I mean, just reading these two, I've never seen either of them before. But it's like they exist in different worlds.
They really do.
Where the one on the left is basically designed to get people to say positive things about how wonderful things are and how we're perfect.
Right.
And the one on the left, or the right, is intended to elicit concerns or potential problems.
Right, and it's a valid, reliable tool.
So who didn't want you to change it?
No. I mean, as I said, Dr. Feinberg was in agreement, and he realized that it was that it would be a better tool. But this is kind of things that you know we run into. Everybody, not just in patient safety, but you run into time and time again. And there's resources. Staff are burned out in surveys. You know, he was reluctant to just go ahead and say, okay, we're doing a new survey. So it kind of got pushed down the road a little bit to the next time the staff satisfaction survey is going to be implemented, then hopefully we will be able to expand it to these 50 items, but it's still a work in progress.
The great thing about ARC, though, and then I know you have a comment, Ron, but ARC, I believe you can actually do a gap analysis and actually intervene, say, at a unit level and have actual data that could allow you to do that. So that, you know, it's more actionable, I believe.
And you can't do that with the Moorhead?
Well, maybe.
The Moorhead, I haven't looked at the analysis of those. Moorhead, you can compare against actual UHC hospitals within the Moorhead, but as I said, we just don't feel that the measure is sharp. I mean, one of the things, I mean, as I said, I don't think there's necessarily a resistance to doing it. It's my point more is that the implementation of it is very difficult in terms of the fact that we weren't able to just go out and say, I want this measure done across the hospital because there's just kind of practical concerns there. Hopefully we will, but it's more just an example of the challenges of, I'd like to do this measure, but you can't really always measure everything that you want to measure.
In that kind of consideration of what's the burden of doing the survey, is it really statistically analyzed in terms of, you know, what percentage of the whole group do we have to survey, or does everyone get slammed with everything all the time?
I think the idea is ideally, I mean, I think Ark, you would want to do it across the hospital. I mean, all staff, everybody. Because it's you know,
sure, you can do it across all staff, but you know, you can get valid survey results with a sample that might get you where you want to go.
I don't know. I would need to look into that because you would do a random sample. I think the general idea with the ARC is to get more just like that global picture, not necessarily to be able to kind of say have statistical significance, but to say where my problem is. But I guess you could actually. I mean, that's something we should look into.
So,
just is the Moorhead free? Because the ARC measure's got to be free, right?
ARC's free. Moorhead's a private consultant firm, actually.
Yeah, that would be another reason to switch.
They administer kind of staff satisfaction in general. But that's another good point. As I said, we're still hoping to get the ARC implemented. It was just we weren't able to do it. We thought it was an important measure, and the point being is we weren't able to do it as and when we wanted to, just for practical reasons. Yes, Dr. Schmidt.
So if the goal is to make this the safest hospital in the country.
Yeah.
In the world.
In the world. That's the vision. The vision may be realized decades from now, but that's the vision.
One is reminded of the great Japanese filmmaker Kurosawa. When he was given an honorary Oscar by these pompous guys, he said, "Now I feel an even greater obligation to learn something about film." the notion that we could be the safest in the world is, of course, absurd. But if one wants to move in the direction of safety, the first thing you have to do is to unearth all your skeletons.
Right.
Right? Yeah. And one needs a plan or a scheme that wouldn't necessarily... I mean, it's just like quality of care measures where people want to cherry-pick the measures that they can look good with.
I mean, I think we, in terms of us as being a new institute working within the health system, I mean, I think we have to be careful about
the tendency to want to talk about it in a more general way.
So,
are they providing you access to the results of those, by the way?
To the Moorhead, yes, yeah. We do have those. Again, when we've kind of looked at them and didn't find them to be terribly meaningful, because we did because the measures are so tame.
And it's a ceiling effect, essentially.
Yeah. So what do you look at then? As I said, there's limits. We have different methodologies, there's weaknesses, there's competing priorities in terms of what we want to look at, and then what are the numbers you're looking at, how meaningful are they, and will you be able to use these numbers to lead to change and improvement? So that kind of got us to thinking, well, maybe just follow the money. Just in terms of what we look at, what we measure, how do we motivate a health system, then maybe we start with money and work backwards. Think about, and I'm not talking about complex cost models, I was trying to think about how can we identify those high priority patient safety events. So CMS, as you're probably familiar with, has introduced a number of kind of carrot and stick financial measures to promote better patient safety. There's the hospital acquired conditions, value-based purchasing, and the hospital readmission reduction program. I'll just talk briefly about three of those. So, hospital-acquired conditions was part of the Deficit Reduction Act of 2005, and basically it required a quality adjustment in the MSDRG payments for certain hospital-acquired conditions. The idea being that if you were in one MSDRG and you were in for a certain procedure, then you had a hospital-acquired condition such as pressure ulcer fall and trauma, catheter-acquired urinary tract, vascular, etc. If one of these things had happened to you in hospital, then would have bumped you into a higher MSDRG category. The idea is that no longer will you be moved up to that category. You would be paid at the original category, and the costs, the extended stays, would then be due to the hospital. So basically, the hospital's losing money because they still have to treat the patient, but CMS is saying, we're not paying you for these hospital-acquired conditions. Now, when it comes to Ronald Reagan, the kind of conventional wisdom suggests that that's not really an issue. Because of the high PACE mix index, most of our patients are already in that higher MSDRG, and it doesn't really make any difference. Because we were going to get paid at a higher level anyway, based on the complexity and the comorbidities of the typical patients that we see at Ronald Reagan. That may not be the case for Santa Monica, and given that Santa Monica is now expanding, and more general medicine cases, I believe, are being moved down there, that population is going to change, and there may be a greater impact there in the fact that patients that don't necessarily, that wouldn't be in these higher MSDRGs based on the complexity of their case, but if they did acquire a hospital-acquired condition, they will not be reimbursed for them. It hasn't been rigorously assessed. We don't really know. There was an initial analysis done, and the idea, and it was assumed that it was minimal. At least at Ronald Reagan, it was minimal, the impact of this particular program. As I said, I suspect once we look a bit closer at it, that Santa Monica may have a bigger issue.
One quick point on that, though.
Yeah.
You said that Ronald Reagan was the worst in catheter-associated infections in the county, right?
That was, in vascular catheter-associated infection, that was based on Medicare non-risk-adjusted results. They basically took a denominator.
I guess my point is simply that you're right about upcoding not being an issue for most hospitals at the level of complexity like Reagan. But with ACA, the top quarter percentile, the top 25 percentile hospitals, and most poorly performing are going to take a very big hit. I don't know where you know Reagan sits on that, but your initial comment about us having the worst catheter associated infection, that's going to be a major ding to the enterprise.
Right, and it might be, now which aspect of ACA are you referring to with the 25%
for the hospital associated conditions in 2014? Those hospitals that are in the top 25 percentile of poor performers across those conditions will take a 1% hit on all Medicare reimbursement across the board.
Right, is this value-based purchasing you're talking about, or the hospital-acquired condition?
Hospital-acquired condition.
And this is based on the MSDRG, or you're talking about
a separate
MSDRG program?
Adjustment. So my point is simply to say, I don't know that we're in the top 25 percentile, but your initial comment saying that we're a poor performer, at least one of those 10, you know, it's some leverage.
Right. I mean, we are. I mean, we were a poor performer on a number of the measures, actually. And this program, which I think it might be the one you're referring to, because the hospital acquired condition is fairly specifically related to the MSDRGs. This is one where we're talking about the reduction. So value-based purchasing is, starting in 2013, your entire payments are going to be cut by 1%. And then it's going to ratchet all the way up to 2% in 2017. And then you will have the hospitals will have the capacity to earn back these dollars based on their performance and quality and safety measures. So Medicare has initially, the measures are basically just surgical care improvement and HCAHPS. Then it's going to go to mortality measures, ARC safety measures, and also the HICs are going to be added into this program. So as opposed to how they're currently just doing it, on that you don't get marked up, but then your performance on those HSCs is going to be measured. And you're going to be compared to it's a relatively complex kind of, as ever with CMS, you know, they have a formula in terms of how they're going to calculate your performance versus the rest of the country's performance. And so the idea is you're going to get 1% cut off, and you need to perform pretty highly to get that all of that 1% back. Current projections that we have would suggest in the first year, just based on the HCAHPS and the surgical infections, you know, that could be up to $500,000 that would be lost to the Ronald Reagan hospital system alone, the money that they wouldn't be able to earn back based on their current performance. There's a revenue neutral program that's CMS is planning to redistribute the dollars from the worst performing to the best performing hospitals. It's also going to be very flexible. They're going to keep introducing new conditions, new requirements. They can, and it's going to be very easy for them to change the scores and change the standards. And like I said, those standards, the vascular catheters, we're pretty poor on those. You know, and those kind of things we are going to get dinged on. The other one, which we won't talk too much about, is the hospital readmission reduction program. That's beginning in October 2012. Again, it's good. They're going to look at what's your readmission rate versus what we calculate your readmission rate should be based on, you know, risk adjusted based on the cases that you had. Initially, that's going to be the ones that they've been tracking forever: heart attack, heart failure, and pneumonia. But it's going to expand to COPD and various cardiac and vascular surgical procedures. Now, it's not totally clear yet how this is going to be calculated, but underperforming hospitals, basically with an excess readmission ratio, are going to have their total at MSD achieved. There's going to be a group, and right now I suspect it might be the fourth quartile of worst performers. Their total MSDRG payments for all discharges, not just the ones that are readmitted, but across the board, will be cut by 1% in 2013 and then up to 3% in 2015. It's also quite possible that at some stage that it may be extended from 30-day to 60 or 90-day readmissions. Wow. And you know, and if we just look kind of politically at the uncertainty with Medicare funding, I see these types of programs as where they're going. I mean, again, with SCA, I mean, there's requirements in the law that the payments are quality based, not just quantity based. Then that kind of thinking and kind of look at those led to me to my proposal to the CHQI for the health fellowship, which I got on Friday. So I now have to do this, which is a little scary, lots of numbers. But I want to design and build a model that will illustrate where we are based on our current performance and where we will be on these three programs, where we're going to be in future years to actually look at that. Currently, there isn't a kind of a comprehensive assessment. You know, I've met with reimbursement, and I've met with decision support and stuff, and they have a lot of things that they work on, but they haven't really kind of focused in on these particular programs. But I want to take it a little bit further, and then I want to kind of go look at the hospital unit level and say, identify those events that are contributing, so be it a readmission or a ARC-PSI or a HAC, identify those events that actually lead to lost reimbursement. And then actually dollarize them. Say this pressure ulcer has contributed, in terms of the value-based purchasing program, this pressure ulcer on this unit contributed $7,000 in overall loss to overall loss reimbursement at the health system. Then from there, I could actually provide a dollars dashboard, as I call it, so that I can present to leadership and say, these are the units and these are the dollars. I'm trying to give context. As I said, initially I kind of found the system very nebulous, but money is a great motivator. So if we can present to management and say, this is what's costing us money, and this is exactly how much it's costing it, my hope is that could set the stage for targeted interventions. A manager can look at the dashboard and say, this unit is costing us $100,000 based on current performance. Therefore, it would be worth spending up to $100,000 to improve performance. And to actually use that as a financial rationale and a motivation to actually, to identify. As I said, this is purely, there's a lot of things that are not being looked at in this model. We're just purely looking at what we're not going to get paid for. Put a figure on it, send it back up to management and say, look, it's here. This is very real. This is going to affect us, and it's going to get worse in 2014 and 2015. And use that as our rationale and our motivation for patient safety. It's kind of specific, it's meaningful, you can, you know, everybody knows what dollars mean.
So why don't we just take some questions?
Yes.
Because we're almost out of time.
Any questions?
Or comments?
It's clear that you're doing everything you can to assemble data to be able to respond to these initiatives. What's less clear to me is what the definition of patient safety should be. I mean, the Institute has the opportunity to take a broader or narrower perspective on these things. And I think alluding to Neil Wenger's point a little earlier about the role of clinicians, I mean, I think there's a huge, others might not agree, but there's a huge component of safety
that has to do with does a doctor attend to the details of a clinical situation in a way that allows them to make a correct judgment about what needs to happen, and then does that get executed in a timely manner? Now, I think that some of it's alluded to in this saving stuff, but I don't think it's been very developed in the literature in terms of really trying to understand the role. You know, I mean, if you really want to have the safest hospital in the country, you want to have the best clinicians doing the best work in a structure that prevents mistakes and doesn't promote mistakes.
And that would go somewhat to the culture of CFD across the board. This is not, and in some ways I'm not completely comfortable with this as an approach. In some ways I think it's somewhat antithetical to the kind of the caring professions and looking at there's so many. Yeah. This is intended to be a tool to give some context to these other things. And the idea is if we can really identify and prioritize these things, they're costing us money, then maybe we can use that as a way to kind of look at the underlying things, then what does lead a physician to make those right decisions, or you know, the nursing manager to make sure the patients are turned, or those types of things. This is meant to be a perspective, and as I said, I'm not aware of anywhere else that you can actually put a price tag specifically on each event at a unit level. And it's meant to be a kind of motivation. There are many problems with it. I think it could lead to a kind of more of a shame and blame culture as opposed to a just culture of CFD. But I think that this data is going to be significant. It's going to affect the bottom line, and we can try to use it as a vehicle to get people on board with patient safety and patient safety improvement and on the other things, the more nuanced things that would go with that.
One of the issues with these kinds of data is that the timeliness is not good enough for feedback. You know, like you don't get the answers back in time to figure out, well, what really happened in these cases. What's the timeliness of this going to be like?
Well, how it's going to be is I hope to project it over 5 to 7 years. So I'm going to start with the most recent year of the hospital-specific reports that Medicare has. Mm-hmm. So then plug that into the model and then project it out over the next 5 to 7 years based on that year's performance. Then the next year's data comes out.
Yeah.
Then we'll update our model, you know, kind of see where the issues are. But you're right; it's not about event reporting.
Very
delayed. It's not about going back to it's about identifying the pattern across the hospital. I'm expecting to see some areas being greater offenders than others. So it's not about going back and doing a root cause analysis or anything like that. It's about saying these are the units, these are the events that are and will. It's a projected loss. If we continue this performance, that's more the way to look at it. Cool. This is our performance. This is what it's going to cost us in 2017.
Okay, maybe one final question or comment.
Yeah, well, I think that this is a good first step, you know, but I do think that at some point you will probably need to set up the machinery to do the root cause analysis, which is not going to be all that different than what David Bates did, you know, with looking at adverse drug events, where you actually are going to go follow back every single event, and you need to set up some type of machinery to actually be able to assess that.
Absolutely.
Because it was pretty extensive in terms of what they did for that, and, you know, that's just only in one category. If you're looking at all patient safety events, you're really going to need a lot more evaluative capacity.
I agree. In this case, I'm looking at the ones that Medicare is looking at. This is a perspective is to go from one end and use that as a highlighting thing. This isn't the cure. There isn't a fix in here at all. This is to give this information to management and say, because management listens to money. This is money. Mm-hmm. You're going to lose this money unless you devote the resources to do something about these events.
In some ways, isn't this exactly the wrong way to fix the system?
I don't disagree. I have real concerns about it. That it's kind of backwards. But this was born out of some frustrations about how do you motivate management to do things. But it's also very real. It's very real, and these are going to continue to affect the bottom line of the health system, and it's one aspect. It's context. It would go to senior leadership. You know, and you can use that to kind of maybe just identify problem areas. But you're right, this isn't necessarily the way we should be thinking about things. I would much rather be addressing a culture of safety, for example, to try and start at that level because that would go to Dr. Shapiro's point as well, is what is it that makes people make those decisions to coordinate care effectively? This doesn't do that. This is purely about saying, this is what it's going to cost us. And to provide maybe a cost, a rationale for, if this is going to cost me $50,000, I can afford to spend $50,000 trying to improve this.
Or figuring out how not to admit that patient who might get a pressure ulcer.
Right.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Right.
Well, so I think at some point, as your center matures, you should involve clinicians who can concentrate on, you know, whose expertise is in these areas of trying to understand the clinical process and what it takes. There's so many incentives for providers not to provide good care now. You know, the pressure to get patients out of the hospital quickly, the pressure to bill aggressively in all the settings in which they work and so on, which are not necessarily the things that are going to promote sort of careful, thoughtful judgments that would not lead to these kinds of situations.
I guess my only point to that is we're in those situations already, you know, and there's been a lot of attempts to kind of address safety over the last 10 years, and again, this is just another approach. There's obviously a lot more to it than that.
Well, thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thanks very much. Thanks for inviting us.